Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, March 3rd, 2014. As Russia takes control of Crimea, the conflict over Ukraine widens. And we turn to some rock and roll from the 80s by the Stranglers and a song called North Winds Blowing. Check this out.
I saw youth on fire. I saw metal machines that were turning on a generation that hadn't yet tired. I heard of two generations being murdered in a Europe that was shrouded in black. I witnessed the birth pains of new nations when the chosen people finally went back.
North winds are blowing across Europe and eastward toward Russia. North winds flowing eastward, I don't know. I'm in trouble with the metaphor police on this one. But it is quite an amazing and complex picture in Ukraine and the U.S. and European allies' reaction and the situation, which is pretty much under the control of one Vladimir Putin. Because as the world watched, we saw a coup that took out the Yanukovych government and put him on the run. We saw the Olympics final ceremonies followed by a week of Russian activity as first soldiers with no insignias on their uniforms took key positions at airports and public buildings in Crimea. And now, with approval of the upper house of the Russian parliament, Putin has ordered forces to consolidate control of the Crimean Peninsula. And Obama reportedly spent 90 minutes on the phone with Putin over the weekend on Saturday. And the U.S. can make threats, but it's pretty clear that we are not going to launch any military action against Russia. And I don't think Putin cares much about sanctions, travel restrictions, and the other kind of external penalties that the U.S. is talking about. And the situation is moving rapidly. My approach here will not to be to try to bring you every event as it occurs, but to give you some of the critical analysis of what's going on. But it always helps to know what the latest developments are. The man who heads the Ukrainian Navy, or did for 48 hours, Denis Berezovsky, swore allegiance to the pro-Russian regional leaders of Crimea and apparently handed over some ships that were in a corner, kind of blocked in by Russian ships at the Black Sea Fleet ports. And this is just another blow to the fledgling regime in Kiev. And it's interesting that term regime is so loaded because the U.S. uses regime and terrorists to describe governments and military operators that it doesn't approve of. And I am borrowing that to say it's very hard to confer any legitimacy on the people who are currently running Ukraine. John Kerry is hopping on a jet. He's on his way right now to Kiev. But what can he do except offer some of his thundering blowheartedness and try to promise restructuring, some of that good old crisis capitalism to come from the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, a dose of austerity for the people of what remains Ukraine, the risk that the country will splinter further with the eastern border joining Russia? Yanukovych seems to be the odd man out on all accounts. But how can the U.S. claim legitimacy for the successors of a man who was elected? And as you've heard me say, there are no saints in Ukraine. Yanukovych, Yushchenko, Timoshenko. You can't find a hero among them. But there are some fascinating developments. First of all, John Kerry was thundering on the television talk shows in Washington on Sunday, and he issued this priceless statement. He said, "You just don't invade another country on a phony pretext in order to assert your interests." Oh, you mean like Iraq, like Afghanistan? Our not-so-secret support for those who want to destabilize the government of Syria? The U.S. does not have any moral high ground to be preaching to Putin from. And of all people, Putin knows that. And so he can easily, you know, survive a 90-minute harangue from Barack Obama and then just say, "Mr. President, stick it in your big ears." Now, the latest threat from the United States and its allies is that they will cancel the G8 summit that is scheduled for Sochi, I believe, in June. And, of course, Putin doesn't really care about that. It's not going to have any measurable impact. He's not going to say, oh, if you do that, I'll have to withdraw from Crimea. And so, on the surface, we have a new Cold War that is bubbling up. We have an Obama administration that is hammered from its political right, people like John McCain, Lindsey Graham lecturing the White House for its failure to take forceful action. What the hell do they want? If, for example, we decided to take over Baja California, would we be very happy if the Russians said, "Oh, we're going to take military action if you do that"? And I think Russia has a much greater claim to Crimea. However, you know, legally untenable it might be based on treaties and other understandings. But Russia has much more connection to Crimea than my example of the U.S. and Baja California. Now, in a moment, I'm going to take you into a backstory that is stunning. And it takes a few minutes to explain, and I will do that for you, because I was quite stunned when I got this information late on Friday. But before I do, I want to remind you that we've gone through some equipment upgrades here at the Peter B. Collins Secret Studio to bring you better audio quality in our podcasts. We had some equipment that failed, and so we bought a new board and a new sound card, and we're still working out some of the bugs. But I want to thank listeners who have stepped forward to help me cover the costs of this unexpected expense. Joe Carson in Tennessee, Diane Rappa in Massachusetts, Jerry in Southeast Portland has not been a subscriber in the past, but he popped $25 in the mail to me. Edward Lowe made a $10 contribution on PayPal, said, "I want you to pay for that new equipment." And Brian Mossy also emptied what was left in his PayPal account to help us out. And I would appreciate your support, whether it's a direct donation to help with the audio upgrade or a subscription. The subscription offers $1 for a 24-hour pass, $5 a month, or if you're comfortable, you can pay more, $10 or $20, to help support our efforts. The best deal is our $50 annual subscription. And for new annual subscribers inside the continental U.S., I've got some bonus gifts, including the rock and roll CD by John Dist called Red Flag, a lot of great tunes on here, and a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans, courtesy of our friend Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. And if you haven't done it yet, check out the offer for a free one-month trial subscription at audible.com. If you take advantage of that, Audible will give you your first audiobook download free, and then you can stay with them or cancel as you wish before 30 days. If you do that, you won't owe them a penny. But just for trying it out and because I've referred you, Audible will pay me $15 America. So it's an easy way for you to kick in some money from somebody else to help support the Peter B. Collins podcast, and I hope you will consider doing that. Now to this fascinating story. There is a website that's a fairly recent news and technology site called Pando. One of its writers is Mark Ames. And it's important to know that Mark Ames spent a couple of years in Moscow as the editor of an anti-Putin publication. And he was eased out and asked to leave by the Russians. So he has contacts there. He has history in the region and with the government of Russia. He also is a critic of Glenn Greenwald. And the new website called First Look, where Greenwald has deployed his resources and is publishing articles on a regular basis now based on the disclosures from Ed Snowden and the NSA. So, in this article at Pando, it opens by talking about one of the latest hires, along with Glenn Greenwald, over at the First Look website, and that is a highly respected blogger named Marcy Wheeler. Marcy had her own site called Empty Wheel. Before that, she was at Fire Dog Lake. She does great legal analysis, and I have high respect for Marcy Wheeler. She wrote a piece that was picked up by Mark Ames and the people at Pando, where she kind of asked, is there something behind the opponents in Ukraine? Is the United States quietly or covertly supporting what appears to be a liberation movement? Liberation from a corrupt but democratically elected government. And what Ames does is pretty devastating to what Marcy Wheeler wrote. He said, well, there is a billionaire who has co-invested with the U.S. government who is investing in some of these opposition groups in Ukraine. And his name is Pierre Omidyar. Omidyar is the billionaire founder of eBay. They also own PayPal. And he has a foundation called the Omidyar Network. And according to this article at Pando, I'll link to it and you can read it for yourself. It'll be in the show file at peterbcollins.com. Omidyar's network has provided nearly $200,000 to an organization that is run by a man who is was mentored by Yushchenko. Yushchenko was the guy who came out ahead in the so-called Orange Revolution, when the Bush administration demanded that the vote be rerun in the fall of 2004, if I remember correctly. Then Yushchenko was displaced by Yanukovych. So the figure to keep in mind here is a guy named Oli Rybachuk. He was a right-hand man to Viktor Yushchenko, worked with him for many years. And so, on the face of it, the idea that Pierre Omidyar, a billionaire, is funding these so-called democracy movements that are agitating against, as I said, a corrupt but democratically elected government raises serious questions. The other piece that is astounding is that the other major funder of this non-governmental organization called Center UA is the United States government through USAID, which is widely regarded as allied with the CIA and a way of providing financial support for some of the covert friends of our government. And so this leads to much deeper questions, not only about Omidyar's role in this coup in Ukraine, but about what his motives are in putting up $250 million, hiring Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras, Jeremy Scahill, Marcy Wheeler, and Matt Taibbi to date. And does Omidyar have an agenda? Does it affect the work of Glenn Greenwald? Does that agenda involve Pierre Omidyar reviewing, editing, or approving the work that Greenwald does, particularly based on the disclosures of Ed Snowden. And of course, there's much that we simply have no evidence or information on. And that's one reason why my friend Sibel Edmonds, who has written 6 or 7 blistering columns about this nexus of Snowden, Greenwald, Omidyar, Sibel has raised some very important questions. But when she reached the conclusion, in my view, premature and not supported by the evidence, that Ed Snowden in particular and Glenn Greenwald in addition were quote-unquote charlatans, well, I'm not there. I don't have enough evidence to support that. And over the weekend, Glenn Greenwald wrote a column which in some ways was kind of snarky and dismissive of the reporting of Pando, but he did explicitly say that Pierre Omidyar has no access to the Ed Snowden documents that are under the control of Glenn Greenwald, and that Greenwald has not submitted any of, I think, 4 articles now that he has written for the Omidyar-funded site since the first week of February. Now, that conflicts with quotes that Mark Ames cites from Jeremy Scahill talking about how much Pierre Omidyar is directly involved in the day-to-day management of First Look. So these are important questions, and my best advice is that we all exercise appropriate skepticism about Snowden, about Greenwald, about Omidyar, about what we read in the American media, about what's going on in Ukraine. We've gotten ourselves into what I would call a house of mirrors. It's hard to separate real images from reflections, refractions. And as we work through this crisis in Ukraine, there is also clearly a crisis in media in the United States. My friends over at Project Censored, Peter Phillips and Mickey Huff, declared us in a truth emergency several years ago. And I think that remains today. And as we see the United States working with European allies to try to isolate Russia, say, keep your hands off the Ukraine, we hear this fatuous remark from John Kerry. It is really difficult to know where the truth lies. And my commitment to you is that I will continue to pursue it and to call them as I see them. But I acknowledge that we are all dealing with received information, and we have to be very careful to analyze it critically and skeptically. On to other news now. You know about the Obama administration's capture-kill program. Mostly we have killed suspects with drone strikes or commando raids. But there is one exception, and he faced trial starting today at a courtroom in Manhattan. The suspect is a Kuwaiti-born cleric, Suleiman Abu Ghaith. He married into the bin Laden family, marrying Osama's daughter Fatima, or Fatima. And according to the indictment and the case brought by American prosecutors, he was a high-ranking official with Al-Qaeda. Yet the government's case to date, we haven't seen the evidence, is at most that he had knowledge of what senior Al-Qaeda figures were thinking, planning, and doing. So far, there is no direct connection. They suggest he had knowledge of Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, but not that he was in any way directly involved. And get this, they are thinking of calling as a witness for the defense Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's facing his own trial at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. He was supposed to be tried in Manhattan. That was Eric Holder and Barack Obama's desire, but they had to yield to Yahoo's loud and ignorant yahoos who said that it would be an insult to the victims of 9/11 to try him in New York. And there is no plan to bring Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to New York. He would testify by video if he does. So it'll be very interesting to see. Abu Ghaith has been on ICE for a long time. In 2002, he was smuggled into Iran, but he was then arrested and held there until January of last year. He was released by the Iranians. He went to Turkey. There he was held for more than a month before being flown to Jordan and handed over to the United States in what he called a kidnapping. So this is going to be a very interesting trial. And while I have no basis to guess whether this man is guilty or not, I would say that the evidence to date is pretty weak in terms of directly linking him to terrorist activities. And on the other hand, I am pleased to see that they didn't Gitmoize him. They didn't use the National Defense Authorization Act on him. He's being held in an ordinary lockup in New York and tried in a courtroom in Manhattan. And that's the way I believe these cases should be handled. Also, to date, he has not taken a guilty plea, which means that there will be evidence aired and we'll be able to evaluate that evidence ourselves. In another case that is drawing quite a bit of attention, the court-martial for sex crimes of a general from the 82nd Airborne, Jeffrey Sinclair, it is lurching forward and is scheduled to begin on Tuesday. But the trial's been thrown into disarray because the lead prosecutor resigned after telling his colleagues that it would be very difficult to prove at trial some of the sex charges brought by the complaining witness, a female captain. And in particular, that her claim that General Sinclair forced her to perform oral sex on him while they were serving in Afghanistan appears to be undermined by her attempt to provide greater evidence of her conversations and her, resistance to the demands of General Sinclair. And it revolves around what appears to be newly discovered evidence on the part of this unnamed captain that she found an old iPhone that contained voicemail messages between her and General Sinclair. But apparently the forensic analysis of the iPhone conflicts with her assertions about when she found it, when the calls were made, or things of that nature. And this, of course, is against the backdrop of the massive sex crime crisis in the United States military today. And I want General Sinclair to have a fair trial. Everyone deserves a fair trial. But it appears once again that the system is being gamed to protect the male offender and to put on trial the accuser. And we've seen this happen at the Naval Academy and in too many other of these attempts by victims of sexual abuse in the military to get some justice and expose the perpetrators. On Sunday, 400 or more people were arrested in front of the White House protesting the Keystone XL pipeline. About 1,000 people showed up for the protest, and 400 submitted to voluntary arrest. Here in San Francisco on Monday, there were reportedly 50 to 75 people who took up a similar protest at an office of the U.S. State Department. It's a passport office. And many of them were arrested for the statement that they made. I've been following the story from Carlsbad, New Mexico, of the nation's nuclear waste site called the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant. And on February 5th, this underground facility was shut. Six workers were sent to the hospital for treatment of smoke inhalation after a truck that was hauling salt caused a fire. 9 days later, a radiation alert activated in the area where newly arrived waste was being stored. And preliminary tests show that 13 workers suffered some radiation exposure and monitors as far as a half mile away detected elevated levels of plutonium. And this story is not being suppressed. It has gotten some coverage. But it points up once again that nuclear power is not safe, that we don't know what to do with the nuclear waste. And to be fair, this waste is mostly generated from nuclear weapons manufacturing facilities. But the bottom line is, we don't know what to do with the nuclear waste that we already have. This coming Sunday, March 9th, the annual march across the Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, will take place. And if you live in the South and are a listener to this podcast, more power to you. If you can get your butt to Selma, I hope you will join the groups of people who are going to be marching in support of former Governor Don Siegelman. And some of those same people and others will be marching in support of my friend and colleague Roger Shuler, who has been locked up for more than 4 months in Shelby County, Alabama, for practicing journalism. And Roger Shuler faces another court appearance, I believe it's Wednesday this week, in a second defamation case that has been brought by the current Attorney General of Alabama, Luther Strange, over Shuler's reporting that he had an affair. And Shuler has been abused. He was wrongfully arrested. He is unconstitutionally detained. And I continue to be very upset at his treatment and the failure of the system to work properly to protect his rights. Also in Alabama, the New York Times ran a lengthy story over the weekend in the Sunday paper about the only women's prison in Alabama. It's called the Tutwiler Center, where correction officers have raped, beaten, and harassed women inside this prison for at least 18 years. More than a third of the employees have had sex with prisoners, which is sometimes the only way that women get basics like toilet paper, personal effects, clean uniforms, and bedding. And this is not a recent development. As you heard, it's been going on for years and years. And despite that, part of it is driven by overcrowding, where this women's prison has more than twice the capacity of prisoners, and it is highly understaffed. There are only 3 video cameras in the whole prison, so that there are plenty of places where people can go and break the rules and not get caught. And to add insult to these obvious injuries, the state has actually reduced funding for the Alabama prisons and the women's prison by millions of dollars. And correction officials and other government leaders who are well aware of this problem continue to let that kind of barbaric subhuman behavior go on. Finally today, just another ding for St. Steve Jobs. There's a lawsuit, a class action on behalf of 64,000 people who work in Silicon Valley who believe that they were blocked from job opportunities at competing companies by a secret pact that was put in place at the behest of Steve Jobs after Google tried to hire one of Apple's top web browser programmers. Sergey Brin says that Steve Jobs warned in an email, "If you hire a single one of these people, that means war." Now keep in mind that for a while, up until Google developed its own telephone that competes with the iPhone, Steve Jobs was on the board of Google. And so the incestuous relationships in Silicon Valley between Google, Apple, Facebook is not alleged to be a part of this cabal, but Pixar and Lucasfilm, which was sold by George Lucas to Disney last year, were all part of this no-poaching pact. And I think this is really important because I used to live in Silicon Valley. I was there when Apple Computer was starting. I actually did some jobs for Apple, not for Steve Jobs, but some production work for them many years ago. And Silicon Valley is a virulently anti-union zone. Most of the employees there think that with their stock options and their 401ks that someday they're going to be like Steve Jobs. So they don't want unions, they don't want work rules. They rely on the generosity of the plantation owners to give them free popcorn and all the lattes that they want. Video games and skateboards are okay inside the workplace in many cases. The trade-off is that these people are captive to that plantation. And this agreement is a matter of collusion to keep down the cost of employees to suppress wages. And I know some of the people who have worked as editors for Lucasfilm. Many of them are non-citizens who were brought here on H-1B visas and work 60 to 70 hours a week. Now, they're paid above minimum wage, well above it, $70,000, sometimes $100,000 a year. But they are captive to the employer who got them that H-1B visa. And it appears that what Jobs did was say, well, I've got these captive people on H-1Bs. I'm going to make sure that citizens are captive as well. And this really rips the veneer off Silicon Valley as this wonderful place where entrepreneurial spirit is alive and well, and that everyone has a shot at the brass ring. Steve Jobs is going to be on a stamp next year. And as I've mentioned, that's one stamp I will not be licking.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.